And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Ever wondered what's going on inside your pet's head? When your dog runs up and greets you, wagging her tail and looking you in the eye, is she happy? Or is she just reacting instinctively? Do animals feel the loss of a mate? Do animals have closer friendships with some animals than with others? Today, we talk with one of the world's leading ethologists about all of this and more when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Science. Today, we take a fresh look at it, because in many ways, science is changing, in ways many of us will find interesting. Science is very much like a religion, in that it seeks to find the truth. Unlike religion, which relies on faith, science progresses on facts. But this can lead to some interesting and sometimes frustrating moments for someone like me who is a scientist and who has devoted his life to understanding the nature of life, the mysteries of animal friends, and how this all relates to we humans, who claim the position of masters of the realm. The other day, I came across an article which in essence announced that researchers had discovered that dogs actually laugh. It seems that somewhat by chance, a university prof and her students recorded the sounds of dogs at play and discovered a unique sound diagram that was associated with dogs playing with each other. To test their concept, they then played recordings of the dog laugh to other dogs, and lo and behold, the dogs seemed to want to have some fun. Puppies picked up their favorite toys. Dogs in kennels listened attentively. And from all of this, it was discovered that dogs laugh. Well, I had a wonderful dog, actually a wild dog from the Navajo Reservation, named Bean Dog. She was colored like a pinto bean, and so the name. Bean Dog was one of the most amazing creatures. She was amazingly smart, and although she was just a medium-sized dog, Bean Dog always won any skirmish. She was fast, and she was able. She was also an incredible flirt, and was very selective about which males she would pay any attention to, and I was always pleased with her choices of male companionship. No mutts or scraggly dogs for Bean Dog. I'll always remember one day in Portland, Oregon, when I was walking with Bean Dog, and she spotted a massive, handsome, regal, powerful Great Dane. You could see that it was love at first sight. She was smitten, and she exhibited a total change in Bean Dog behavior as she went into what was absolutely a wildly flirtatious interaction, head up, intense eye contact, the usual sniffing and nosing around. And then she just began an intense frolic with the Great Dane. He couldn't help but notice, although due to his size, he couldn't possibly move as quickly as she. But from that moment on, Bean Dog looked like a dog in love. When we walked around the neighborhood, Bean Dog was always looking for the Dane, and I purposely walked by his house, and then they would greet like soul friends. There was never any sex, but a true affection existed between these two. She showed no similar interest in any other dog, before or after. I'll always remember one misty afternoon. I was inside the house with Bean Dog, and I noticed the Dane walking up the driveway with a huge ox bone in his mouth. Bean Dog seemed to sense his presence, and she got up on her hind legs so she could see out the window, and then she just went crazy with desire to see her best friend. It took me a minute to get dressed for the outdoors, and by the time we made it outside, the Great Dane was already gone. But he'd left behind the giant ox bone for his friend. Bean Dog was filled with great wisdom. She did not tolerate anger between humans in her presence. She would quickly, literally come between any combatants and growl an order to stop. And once, when she witnessed a terrible attack by a pit bull on a neighborhood dog, she came home and got sick. So did Bean Dog smile? Almost all the time. Did she laugh? There were on occasions unique, special moments of joy between Bean Dog and me, when laughter seemed appropriate, and then she bared her teeth by pulling back her lips and pulled back the corners of her mouth so far, and her eyes were filled to bursting with joy, that I have every reason to believe that Bean Dog was definitely laughing. Could I prove it was laughter? Scientifically, probably not. But that was then, and this is now. And science is growing to accept the observations like I just gave, and pay attention, and ask the questions. And there are some wonderful new realms of science that we will be talking about today, as we go in depth with Dr. Mark Beckhoff, one of the world's leading animal behaviorists, as we explore his 30 years of research into the minds of the wild beings. And then we head on out to Hawaii to get an update on the dramatic eruption that recently occurred at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. So, following the news, we explore the wonders of animal emotions. So first, the news. Rising ocean waters have forced 100 people on a Pacific island to move to higher ground in what may be the first example of a village formally displaced because of modern global warming, a UN report said on Monday. With coconut palms on the coast already standing in water, inhabitants in the Latau settlement on Tegua Island in Vanuatu started dismantling their wooden homes in August and moved about 600 meters inland. King tides, as they are called, often whipped up by cyclones, have become stronger in recent years and made Latau uninhabitable by flooding 4 to 5 times a year. King tides are creating problems throughout the region. Off Papua New Guinea, about 2,000 people on the Cantaret Islands are planning to move to nearby Bougainville Island, 4 hours boat ride to the southwest. In the Arctic, indigenous peoples in Shishmaref in Alaska and in Tuktoyaktuk in Canada are preparing to move. Peoples of the Arctic and the small islands of this world face many of the same threats, says Klaus Topfer, the United Nations Environmental Programme's executive director. As the fallout from Katrina keeps getting worse with each passing day, China seems to have its own version of a Katrina aftermath taking shape around the spill of 100 tons of benzene-like carcinogens into the Songhua River. The spill is now spilling over into a political backwash that includes renewed antagonism between Russia and China, as the spill, which occurred November 13th, but was covered up by the Chinese authorities, makes its way along the Songhua River and will be passing through the Russian city of Khabarovsk this weekend. 4 million residents of Harbin, downriver from Jilin, the site of the original chemical plant explosion, were forced to go without drinking water for 5 days. The scope of the environmental impact is just beginning to emerge as ecosystems along the river's course become impacted by the killer chemicals. Within China, a war of wills is developing, much as it is following Katrina, about priorities. People involved in protecting China's environment, which suffers from severe pollution from a variety of sources, are challenging the central government to reassess its priorities to keep its GNP thrumming along and instead deal with this massive disaster. Initial response to the disaster is resulting in many officials being sacked, and a breaking news story reports that Vice Mayor Wang Wai of Jilin, where the explosion occurred, was found dead at his home on Tuesday. Initial reports suggest a possible suicide as the cause, but this has not been confirmed. As the spill enters the Russian Republic, concerns for various animals and ecosystems is rising. Russia is home to a mere 350 to 540 Siberian tigers, and although the risk of tigers being directly affected by drinking the toxic waters is remote, the chance that the animals may eat meat from animals contaminated and sick from drinking the waters is of great concern. Siberian tigers consume on average 450 pounds of meat a week. No resolution to this emerging disaster is forthcoming. In Montana, threats of a civil war over mining rights on public lands is being considered. At least, that's the sense that Montana resident Walter Lohr voices when he considers the newly crafted legislation being promoted by Republican Congressman Jim Gibbons of Nevada and Richard Pombo of California. The bill is an effort to sell public lands to mining interests in the hopes it could raise as much as $158 million by selling 360,000 acres for potential mining. Or at least, that is what is being said. The land sale measure lifts an 11-year ban on the sale of public lands to mining companies and boosts to at least $1,000 the cost per acre, up from the previous $2.50 per acre. The bill allows lands surrounding claims to be sold for undefined sustainable economic development to benefit rural communities, which some translate to mean expensive housing enclaves and ski resorts. Conservation groups in Montana launched a series of television commercials on Monday to raise general awareness of the issue. And while we're in Montana, a new study shows that the majority of people diagnosed with a rare form of asbestos-related cancer over a 23-year period lived along Montana's railroad routes. Although no direct proof can be ascertained, speculation is that the W.R. Gray's vermiculite mine, which provided 80% of the world's ore located in Montana and which used the rails to bring its product to markets and shipping sites, is the most obvious suspect. Vermiculite, used primarily for insulation, is a source of cancer-causing asbestos. And if this observer were to comment on the news that's been developing over the past 40 years about the environment, it is that the calls to maintain the natural systems of forests, rivers, lakes, streams, mountains, prairies, oceans, and the earth should have been heeded a long time ago. As dramatic changes impact the earth's inhabitants each week, the lesson is clear. We must now unite to restore the living systems which have evolved over millions of years and which are starting to collapse as the many warnings go unheeded. Please, do everything you can to save this planet. And that's the news. And a few reminders. Time is running out for you to enter the EI2025.com Energy Independence Song Contest. You have as good a chance as any to be part of the over $3,000 in prize money for the best songs. Songs are already posted on the EI2025.com website, and you can listen to them just like you do to the Wild Side News. So go, take a listen, and for Earth's sake, send in your best song. It's easy to enter, and time is running out. Visit www.ei2025.com for full details. And so, as time runs along with today's show, it's time to get to today's in-depth feature. Science has a unique place in our world. Following a recent announcement that researchers had determined that dogs indeed laugh, it made me wonder, how does science have the right to officially declare such a finding? After all, lots of people have known this for years. And so it brought up the larger question, what else is science discovering about the emotional life of animals? Today we are joined by one of the world's most distinguished animal behaviorists. Dr. Mark Beckoff is professor of biology at the University of Colorado in Boulder, a fellow of the Animal Behavior Society, and a former Guggenheim Fellow. In 2000, he was awarded the Exemplar Award from the Animal Behavior Society and has co-authored a book with Jane Goodall, The Ten Trusts. In addition to the many books and professional articles, he serves on the Scientific Review Board of the Great Ape Trust. As my regular listeners know, one of my absolute favorite topics is animal behavior, because I truly believe that animals are much more complex, much more conscious, much more sentient than a lot of people seem to give them credit for being. And as I've said before, I sometimes feel that the scientific community does some form of disservice in rejecting some of these thoughts. Well, today I'm extremely honored to have a fellow traveler and world animal lover, Dr. Mark Beckhoff, on the Wild Side News, and he's joining us now from his home in Boulder, Colorado. Dr. Beckhoff, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to this interview.
I'm so glad that I can have you on this show because I've found someone who our concepts of the world and our mission is so very similar. I hope we have opportunities to continue this this relationship. But let's talk first of all about you're an ethologist, and just for people who may not understand what that is, give a brief introduction to that.
Well, I'm a biologist who studies animal behavior, and I'm interested in questions about the evolution of behavior, how behavior varies among different species, and especially how behavior varies among members of the same species in different habitats. So I'm also interested in ecological questions. So that's basically it. So in my work on animal emotions, I don't ask the question of whether dogs, for example, have emotions. I know they have emotions, so I'm interested in why they evolve and how they may be similar to or different from the emotions of wolves, which are basically the progenitors of all dogs.
Well, now, of course, that's a bit controversial in the scientific community to say that you know that dogs have emotions. Why don't you give us some background on why you are so prepared as a scientist to say that?
I mean, basically, I think that animal behavior, observing behavior, and the descriptions we provide a lot of information about what animals are thinking and what animals are feeling. And so it just doesn't strike me as being useful to sit around and wonder whether chimpanzees or elephants or dogs or cats or even mice or rats experience different feelings like joy or happiness or grief or fear or anger, for example. I don't know about mosquitoes, and you know, I'm not so sure about certain fish, although there's a lot of new evidence now that fish are sentient and feel pain. So to me, the interesting questions are, why have emotions evolved, and what are they good for?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of our attractions to other animals is the fact that they do have emotional lives. They're not rocks, and they're not trees.
So we're going to just hop over that debate, and we're going to start with the premise and the belief that both of us share, that obviously from our observations and from being living creatures and sharing this planet with other living beings, it's pretty obvious to both of us that that's exactly true, that they do have the capacity for a full panoply of different emotional responses.
I believe that really, as I said before, that's why we bond to other animals and why we bond to other people, is because emotions act as what I call social glue. They help bond us, they attract us or repel us, and they also function as social catalysts. They stimulate different sorts of social interactions and are responsible for the way in which different social interactions unfold over time. So, yeah, we're on the right page. I mean, I suppose it's interesting to some people, but Charles Darwin said it all when he said that the differences among species are differences in degree rather than differences in kind. They're shades of gray rather than absolute differences. So if humans have joy, then so too do many other animals, although dog joy and chimpanzee joy might be different from human joy, it doesn't mean that we have it and they don't.
Let's talk about, since you do comparisons oftentimes between the human and the other beings, let's talk about your thoughts about how these emotions serve as this social glue, as you say, from the human perspective, so that people can then relate to that, and then we'll expand that out into the animal kingdom.
Well, sure, that's pretty easy. When you are with somebody and they're happy, they express it either using words or in their body language or in their movements. And we can share that emotion. And so when I am with somebody who's happy, their joy can catalyze joy in me. It can also mean I'll play with them and I'll bond with them. And likewise, if someone's grieving or sad, we can read it in them and then behave appropriately. And so if I see someone who's grieving or looking sad, I can guess that they are grieving or feeling sad. And I think the really important thing is that, of course, we can be wrong. A lot of my colleagues say, well, we once thought the Earth was flat, and, you know, common sense proved us wrong. But I don't think that thinking the Earth is flat is in the same arena as assigning different emotions to various animals. And just because we're wrong some of the time doesn't mean we're wrong all of the time.
Exactly right. It's not one side or the other.
No, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you like to study the evolution and therefore the purpose of these, what would you say is the evolutionary basis, the survival advantage, I suppose you'd have to say, of emotions? Let's start again, stay with humans to start out with.
Well, I think, you know, it's once again for the development and maintenance of social bonds and social groups. And, you know, we're not all that evolved from our primitive ancestors. And they lived in groups in which you really needed a lot of mutual cooperation. They had to coordinate their behaviors. They had to share tasks. And so it's those sorts of emotions that draw people to one another. It's emotions of being that underlie the notion of being fair and equitable and sharing resources, or cooperatively rearing young, or cooperatively going out and finding food and then sharing it. So, you know, once again, we can see that in humans, and I have no doubt that we also see it in other animals as well.
Let's talk about now how you have approached this process of investigating emotions in animals. First of all, how long have you been at this process?
Oh, about 33 years. More than three decades, I'm afraid.
And what in the world brought you to this quest?
My parents always say that I minded animals, and it's actually the title of one of my books. And they say that when I was very young, I always wanted to know what animals were thinking and what animals were feeling. And so I went through a typical biology education and was in a medical school, and I had to do some dissection. And I just decided one day that that wasn't the way I wanted to spend the rest of my life. So I dropped out of that MD-PhD program and went back to graduate school in animal behavior. So on the one hand, I think it was a passion that was with me from the time I was about, you know, a couple years old.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, I just decided that I really wanted to know what animals were thinking and what animals were feeling, and I didn't want to do any kind of invasive research onto other animals.
Let's go back when you were more of a child. Did you find yourself different than other kids? Did you find this to be a common attribute of your friends, or did you have sort of what appeared to be some sort of unique or special desire to befriend these creatures and get to know them?
Well, you know, at the time, I mean, in retrospect, I suppose I was a little different, but I sure didn't know it at the time. But I think what it was, too, was I grew up in a house where there was just a lot of love and compassion, and I think that kind of spilled over, if you will, into my views of the world at large. And so I never doubted that dogs had feelings. I never doubted that dogs who were yelled at or hit by their owners were feeling you know, pretty crappy about doing that, having had that done to them. And I never doubted that dogs when they were playing, or cats when they were playing, or birds when they were flying, you know, to and fro, were enjoying themselves. I mean, it never dawned on me to ask, well, do they really enjoy it? So that's kind of what has motivated my scientific studies of animal cognition, animal intelligence, and animal emotions.
So you got into graduate school and you began to research these things, and what caught your attention?
My attention mostly was play behavior, because play is a voluntary activity. If I want to play with you, you have to want to play with me. Excuse me. So therefore, we have to cooperate. We have to negotiate these agreements. I have to forgive you if you bite me too hard. I have to trust that you will obey the rules of the game. So there's a lot of give and take. And there's a lot of real small, what I call micro adjustments in behavior on the run, meaning that when two dogs or cats or wolves or bears or mongooses are playing, they have to adjust their behavior all the time to what their play partners are doing. And so what really drew me was, number one, play was fun to watch, and of course I myself like to play. Number two, play obviously is a joyful activity, but really from a strongly academic point of view, it was really the situation of having to do really detailed studies of play behavior and fighting, so I could compare play to fighting or reproductive behavior or predatory behavior. And to that end, I filmed animals and played back frames of play or aggression once at a time. You know, so like, you know, a 15-minute play bout could literally take me a week to analyze.
And of course, the other side of that is the fact that these same animals, let's say that they were wolves or dogs, under a different circumstance, could take the basic elements of that play, the rough and the tumble, the jumping, the biting, the nipping, etc., and kill an animal with it. So there was some sort of agreement.
Absolutely. There's a restraint. We call it self-handicapping, where an animal doesn't bite or hit or, say, slam into another animal as hard as he or she can. So they're adjusting their behavior so that when an adult wolf or dog plays with a younger animal, they don't bite as hard or hit them as hard. And there's also what we call role reversal, when a dominant animal allows herself to be bitten or chased. In a non-play situation, they never would allow that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a whole lot of mechanisms that have evolved that allow animals to keep play in the repertoire without having play escalate into a real fight, for example, or some kind of mating ceremony.
Well, I think your research became really quite transcendental in some respects, was this effort to really analyze the behaviors frame by frame, moment by moment, fraction of second by fraction of second, to see if perhaps there were things happening that we as humans watching in normal time would have missed. And
exactly.
There's some really fascinating things that have come from that. Why don't you give us some insights into how that developed and what you began to notice?
Well, what I noticed early on was that play was a very serious activity, although it's full of fun and frivolity. I also noticed that, like I said before, these animals are really making very small adjustments on the fly, if you will. They don't bite their own lips, they don't bite the lips of the other animals, they don't bite their eyes or their ears. And so what really intrigued me was that part of how I would come to understand what animals were doing when they were playing was by watching these videos, and that would help me to understand how they were cooperating with one another and how they would invite one another to play and how they might say, I'm sorry I'm going to bite you, but don't take it as a real bite, or I'm sorry, I just did bite you. Please don't take it as a real bite. And that got me into about 2 decades of work studying in detail what we call a play bow, which is an activity or an action when a dog or a wolf or a cat or a lion crouches on the forepaws. They put their butt up in the air. They may wag their tail. And in the case of members of the dog family, they may bark.
Exactly.
And so the first thing I did was I noticed that it was a very, very stereotyped or rigid behavior, so that if I bow to you, you would understand that I want to play with you. So, you know, it wouldn't be misinterpreted and it wouldn't be an ambiguous behavior. But then what I also discovered was that dogs and wolves and coyotes were using these play bows strategically, and they were using them immediately before or immediately after they would bite another animal and vigorously shake their head from side to side. So if they used it right before they bit, they would say, you know, I'm going to bite you, but take it as play. And if I just bit you too hard, I might just do a play bow right after the bite as if to say, I'm sorry, please forgive me. And so that just took more than a decade to do, because it's very tedious research. But indeed, we discovered that these animals were using play bows strategically, not randomly, and to communicate, I want to play with you, I'm going to bite you, please don't take it as a fight, for example, or I'm sorry I just bit you. I don't want to fight with you. I want to keep playing with you.
That's interesting. A long time ago, I watched a film called Wolves and the Wolfmen, which is a fascinating study. And one of the researchers was Michael Fox. Perhaps you're familiar with his work. And he made reference to that specific behavior, and he called it an invitation to play, where he would you get down on your hand, your four paws, so to speak, your elbows and hands on the floor with your butt up in the air, and then he would say you'd turn your head to the side and bark and kind of wag your head a little bit, and that was an invitation to play. And I became fascinated with that, and so ever since then, when I meet a dog I don't know but I want to play with, I'll try that, and invariably, this seems to be my observation, that the dog, instantaneously, something changes in them. And
right.
They're excited, and they very often will run around in a circle and come back and, again, do the same thing back to me.
Well, it's a small world. Michael Fox was my PhD mentor.
Well, he's a great character. I really enjoy it. He was a brilliant guy.
Yeah, he is. And it was because of him that I studied play, because when I left the medical school program, he, too, was very much against doing really invasive, if you will, nasty research. So I called him and I told him my ideas, and he basically accepted me to graduate school from the medical school program, you know, over the phone.
Wow, lucky guy.
Yeah, and we were both lucky. I got there, I said, I want to study play. And it was great because that was exactly it. And so from my thesis, a lot of it was that I basically started looking at the mechanisms of play, the dynamics of play. And then I said, Mike, I really want to do a lot more work on this play dial, the play invitation.
Exactly,
and so
right.
It's funny because a lot of people had thought different ascribed different functions to the play dial, but I was actually the first person to really analyze in detail what the play dial meant. And it was all because of discussions and long, long discussions with Michael Fox that I did that research. So it started in my PhD thesis back in 1970.
That's about the time I was showing the film. That's absolutely fascinating because it captivated me as well. I had thought originally, this is fun for me now, because this gets into the realms of real science, but also really fascinating stuff. And that is that I thought that it was kind of a generic thing that you do that once and that would say, okay, let's play. But apparently it goes way beyond that.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I mean, you initially say, let's play. And then depending on how the play is going, you will use play dials in one or, other ways. And so the exciting thing about play is that animals tailor it to their play partner, what their play partner is doing, the gender, the relative size, whether the animal is more dominant or subordinate. So it's extremely complex. I mean, it really is. People who have looked at my videos and have, watched me analyze the videos walk away in awe thinking, my God, this animal play stuff is really, really complex.
Well, some of your research has indicated that there's all sorts of very quick flashes and communications with eyes and teeth and different things that we just wouldn't notice if it weren't for this slowed-down analysis. Why don't you give us something we should try to notice when we watch dogs play?
Sure. You can videotape your dogs or a dog, and then you can, what I suggest to people is watch the video, maybe not the whole video, but watch a chunk of it just to get into the flow of the behavior. And then what you should do is basically slow it down and then begin to see how these animals fine-tune and make these micro-adjustments as they're playing. Look at where they bite one another. Look at when they recoil. Look at when they turn their heads to one side or another to avoid a bite or to deliver a bite, and then you really, really, you get into what I call the rhythm of play. It's a dance, and what you do is you then really watch these animals dance and play, and that's basically it. And then you can, just for kicks, you can start scoring the behaviors. You can see what happens if Fido tries to, you know, bite, you know, Fred too hard or vice versa. What happens if they're strangers? What happens if they're familiar? What happens if it's a female and she happens to be in heat, you know, if she hasn't been spayed?
So
these are the kinds of things that when my niece was 8 years old, she did a study like that. And, you know, within about 5 minutes, she had all the characteristics of play down.
Mm.
So it was, you know, it was exciting to see her get that feel for the animals just by watching them play.
So, for example, how much of this, now we're talking about communication, really. We're talking in these play
social
things.
Social communication,
that's
right.
That's correct. And so, particularly with dogs, there's much that is body, and there are as well vocalizations. What's kind of the mix there? You know, I mean, how much is based on, and also give us some details on how they communicate with their eyes, with their teeth, with their lips, and as well with their voice. That'd be really fun.
Sure. Well, you know what they'll do with their eyes is they'll roll them back and forth. So if you've ever played basketball, you know, or they'll use head and eye movements together. Fake left and go right, for
oh, really?
Example.
Oh, fabulous.
Or roll the eyes in one way and then go the other way. Move the head from one side to another. See if I can get, you know, if I move my head to my left side and then see if I can get you to come try to bite me. And the minute you try to bite me, I move to the right side.
Fabulous.
So that's what I mean by it's a choreographed dance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you and I have agreed we're going to play, so we've gotten through that. And then the choreography is you watch me carefully, and I watch you carefully. So
yes.
You can have very small movements of the head, very subtle movements of the eyes. And then, of course, what you can do is you can throw in vocalizations like what we call the play pant. Some people call it laughter in dogs when they basically go like that. It's a very contagious sound. In fact, if you play it back to dogs, often they'll start playing just when they hear the pant.
Hmm.
Their ears are up. Their lips are pulled back horizontally, if you will, as if they're smiling. They have a very loose gait. The tail's wagging. You know what it is? It's a classical lesson in animal behavior.
Well, I've had great dogs, and I consider dogs to be probably the animal that I can absolutely communicate with the most directly for a whole lot of reasons. First of all, they're a social animal. They're family based. They have to work in packs. They have to work together. So therefore, they're looking at each other and reading behaviors and vocalizations. It's just, you know, and we actually, our behaviors are so very similar with our eyes, with our mouth, our body postures and different things that, the communication is almost direct. So when we return, we continue exploring the mind of the dog and more when Your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.